702
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
9 minutes after 9 o'clock, and here we go. Can I speak? No, my screen isn't giving me the joy that we need here. Let's do this. All right. It appears that we just have a few technical issues that we are dealing with, and here we go. Great stuff. Dr. Christopher Yelverton, head of department in the department, chiropractic department, and of course Professor Shahid Nala, assistant professor in the faculty of health sciences, and I see that they've joined me. Dr. Christopher Yelverton, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Good evening, Aubrey. Thanks very much for the opportunity to speak about some of the research findings that we've done.
Yeah, and of course, Professor Shahid Nala, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an honor to be hosted this evening to talk about a very special find. Thank you.
Yeah, it sounds like quite a recent development. Tell me, when did we have this discovery happen?
Thanks, Robbie. I think let me kick it off. I think one has to go back to March 2008 when Professor Lieberger was exploring the cradle of humankind, which is about 50 kilometers out of Johannesburg, northwest of Johannesburg.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was exploring, as what these explorers do, searching for sites for human evolution, fossils within that space. He took along his little son. It's Matthew Berger. At the time, he was 9 years old. And, you know, while walking through those private-owned lands,
yeah,
I came across what appeared to be a depression in the ground. And one has to just reflect back. Previously, one would look at all those old contour maps and follow lines and explore. But Lee took it to a different level where he looked at Google Maps, which gives you the Google view of certain areas. And utilizing Google view as well as stepping through the felt,
yeah,
he encountered many of these depressions in the landscape. And his little children would run about and explore, yeah, further. Matthew went and turned over what appears to be a little chunk of rock. And from a distance, Lee observed that it's actually one of the upper limb bones, referred to as the clavicle, or part of. Lee did his PhD on the clavicle, so he immediately noticed what this shard of fossilized bone sticking out from this piece of rock.
Yeah.
And I think that's when the whole journey started. And 13 years later, the project is still being studied. So the fossils that are derived from this cave site, which is now called Malapa, and you know, there's from the two fossil specimens that are numbered, MH1 and MH2, those are the initial ones. There's now approximately 5 skeletons that comprise part of this species, an extinct species of Australopithecus, referred to as Australopithecus ediba. So I think that's where the journey started.
Yeah. Let me bring Professor Christopher Yelverton into the conversation. Prof, it appears that for those of us who are perhaps not familiar with the debates that take place in these spaces about the evolution of our species, our earlier cousins, and all of those issues, that there's been a debate that's been taking place, which this particular finding seems to have cleared up. What is that debate? Take us back. What is that debate all about, and what do we now understand?
So I think the discussion really in paleoanthropology, one of the big questions is related to walking upright and having bipedal posture. And I think that a lot of the kind of fossil finds, maybe to just say that as Professor Nala indicated, that, you know, although there are what are considered complete skeletons, they're not necessarily as complete as what we think in our minds as a kind of cadaveric skeleton. A complete skeleton tends to have various parts from different areas. So it might have a fragment of a clavicle and a part of a humerus, a part of the forearm bones, a part of the pelvis. And the lumbar spine, in many cases, is not very well preserved because the vertebrae are quite delicate in terms of the kind of bony prominences that they have. And they're quite important for us to look at in terms of deciding how this animal might have or this creature might have moved around. I think we need to realize that these the Australopithecus sediva was probably around about 2 million years ago that it was walking around, literally walking around in this case, and they were quite small. So they were probably about 1.3 meters tall. So probably around about the size of a 12-year-old modern human. So they were quite small, and the big discussion really is how did these guys move around? Because were they on all fours, or were they predominantly living in trees, or did they have a mixed mode of kind of moving around?
Yeah.
And the debate really then is when did the upright posture that we see in humans, because it's quite unique to humans that we do this all the time. And there's a whole lot of changes that have had to happen mechanically for us to be able to do it effectively, because otherwise it would actually be quite a non-energy efficient way of moving around.
Yeah.
But because of the way our spines have changed, and the pelvis and the knees and the foot, these changes have allowed us to actually do it and actually conserve energy in terms of how we actually move.
Yeah. It appears that embedded in how we move, our physiology, the fact that we, at this point in time, walk upright, speaks of very, very, very important stories about the human being, Professor Nala. What are we supposed to glean from how we move, how we walk, our upright posture? What is that supposed to say to us now? And what is that supposed to mean for the knowledge about human beings?
I think our upright posture speaks to allowing us as a species to explore further. So where we were restricted, and Dr. Yelverton was speaking about living in trees, so that would be arboreal, where you'd be restricted to a specific space, and that space would be dependent on your lifestyle of living in a tree. So when we became more bipedal, we could explore beyond a certain zone.
Yeah.
So as the bipedalism increased, it gave us the greater mobility to explore, and it also freed up our upper limbs. So with the freeing up of the upper limb, when the hands became more usable, where then they could start to be utilized instead of now just used for climbing, they could be used for now, let's call it engineering. So utilizing now the mechanical properties of stone breaking stone to form tools, or maybe even igniting fires. So it freed up our upper limbs when we became bipedal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this allowed us to now further explore away from our home habitat. And this is what we're talking about, the migration that possibly took place. Migration through the plains of Africa northwards, and then expanding across into the sub-Saharan parts of Africa and further into Europe and the world beyond. So I think the bipedalism aspect allowed for freedom.
When you say bipedalism, you're referring to the ability to independently use our main limbs, our arms and our legs, right?
Yes, so you'd be standing on your lower limbs,
yeah,
and then freed up your upper limbs. So the bipedalism, like I said, afforded us the opportunity to become more mobile.
You see,
to then utilize our hands for the technologies that were going to be still coming.
Yeah.
And it also for us to extend the explorative nature of humanity working toward that state.
Dr. Christopher Yelverton, I mean, these are the hidden conversations when we speak of the evolution of the humanoid body, right? Because I think sometimes we don't make the connection between what this discovery means to our understanding of being human. Those are the issues that seem not to surface in conversations around these issues. We get messages and we get write-ups that say, oh, there's been a discovery of this this hominid, and we don't make the link usually in popular conversation as to why this is important, as Professor Nala has just explained, why it's important for us to find this this particular missing link in the debate. What was the thinking before this particular set of artifacts were found?
So I think that the this particular finding that we've got now only really relates to the Australopithecus sediba, because obviously there's a whole lot of other findings and stuff. And as you said, you know, people are always we're always talking about this so-called what is the missing link, what is the derivative here. And I think that with this particular argument, they you know each component is it's almost like a chain event, but the links that we're talking about are not necessarily linear. In moving from a kind of more primitive four-legged ancestor compared to more modern two-legged ancestor, if that makes sense. So it's a lot more complex than that, and it's not like there's necessarily a particular link, because if we look at just the Australopithecus scenario, you know, there were various different Australopithecus species that kind of were at different times during history. And they kind of, some of them were together and some of them were by themselves. And they kind of went extinct. And then the kind of Homo scenario sort of started to move in. And that's also part of the new finds that we've got with like Homo naledi, with the recent finding of Leti, the skull of what was a child in the rising star chambers. And also with that, looking at the whether it was a burial site or whether it was acknowledgement of death or what was going on there. So all of these different things kind of fit together. So it's not really like this is a particular finding that is going to change everything, but it does change our understanding of Australopithecus, which is obviously the focus of it, because that previously there was debate, because we only had two vertebrae, and then we had the pelvis, and we had parts of the limbs that we kind of used to decide and look at how does this guy move around. And the thinking was that he definitely had evidence that he could climb, and then based on the more on the lower limb, we you know that he had some evidence that he might be walking on two legs.
Yes.
But with what we did here, where we found that there were two finds basically, and the one was the lower low back vertebra that we found, which were found in 2008, I think it was. And then they found another sequence of vertebrae that were from the upper part of the low back. And they're looking at where it was found, and because they were actually found on a gravel road that was part of the mining scenario. And the thinking is that when they were building these roads, they actually had dug into where the original findings were, which were the two, the MH1 and MH2 that Professor Nala were talking about. And they linked them, because of their proximity, they linked them together to determine whether or not they could have possibly been from the same individual. And that's one of the very unique things about this particular finding is that they did actually end up being from the same individual in all likelihood based on how they articulate. which makes it very unique as well, because there's very few complete lowbacks in the fossil records. And if we look at certain measurements and what we look at, it means that there can be a much more accurate determination of how Australopithecus sediba actually moved around, essentially.
Professor Nala, do you think that there could have been different species of Australopithecus at a particular time? In other words, here we are speaking about Australopithecus sediba, right? Could there have been other Australopithecus, a species of Australopithecus around the same era, around the same time?
I don't think the same species of Australopithecus. There may have been other species that would have been transitional. So if you look at sediba, it's even Australopithecus species that is extinct now, but it may be a transitional species between a predecessor and then an antecessor. So, you know, there would be times of overlap. And this is something that we have to understand. Evolution is not revolution.
Yeah.
Evolution is a very slow process that happens over thousands of years. And therefore, you get transitional species where we see these changes taking place over time. One of the fundamental concepts that I always relate to my students, and that is always relate structure to function and function to structure. So the body will adapt to requirements that it has in terms of functionality. How would structures become modified? How would structures change depending on the needs that would be required? So when we look at bipedalism, how does the body adapt itself? How is the body modified when it transitions from quadrupedalism to bipedalism?
Yeah.
So we are now going and changing a whole posture. And in the change of the posture, it is not only the back that gets impacted. Because, you know, for example, in the skull, you've got a large opening referred to as the foramen magnum.
Yeah.
When you look at that foramen, it actually changes its position relative to the vertebral column, or the orientation thereof relative to the vertebral column, as one migrates from a quadruped to a biped. And it is not only that. And, you know, this is the one challenge that we face. As a paleoanthropologist, as an anatomist, I'll be a specialist in a specific region. But there are other specialists of other regions. And this is where Prof. Lee Berger has been phenomenal in paleosciences.
Mm.
He brought it to a different level.
Yeah.
Where instead of working in isolation, he's brought these teams together, not only on the sediba project, but also on the Homo naledi project.
Yes.
Where you have these teams working as one entity with all the specialists in terms of regional specialities coming together to look at the overall picture of what this species specifically looked like and did. So you know, one of the questions that can be asked is, what's the importance of Australopithecus sediba? I think one has to look at the impact not only in terms of where sediba in the history of human evolution, but also the project of sediba, how it changed the way the paleosciences changed.
Yeah, yeah.
Where now there's increased technologies coming to play. Like I mentioned, Google Earth was something that was non-existent.
Yeah,
possibly yeah. 50 years.
So what you're saying to me is that Australopithecus sediba doesn't actually just tell us a story about its time, but it also unravels a process of technological advancement for our time.
It would be one step in a timeline that brings us to where we are at now.
Very, very interesting. Let me ask Dr. Yelverton this question. Dr. Nala talks about this particular species, Australopithecus sediba, being transitional. What makes a particular species transitional? Are we, as Homo sapiens, transitional?
Evolution hasn't stopped yet. So, you know, we can't really tell. You know, if you look, you were asking about the different Australopithecus that have existed. And if you go back, some of them were probably around about 4 million years ago or 3 million years ago. And, you know, also still in almost the same areas potentially, but not, you know, the Africanus, for example, was in Stagfontein, which was relatively close to where you find Sidiba and the Homos. So although they're transitional, their transitional period could be a few million years. It's not that they're necessarily there for a short period of time, and then the next one comes in. And I think that's always difficult to understand. Why did that particular species not continue to exist, and why did the next species kind of continue? Homo sapiens is, although in relative terms, we've been around actually quite a short period of time compared to some of the others. Some of the others were probably around for longer than what humans have been around. But in terms of the current thinking, though, the Homo sapiens are one of the most successful, partly because we've managed to manipulate our environment to a much larger degree than many other species can. If you think of what, you know, moving into cold areas or hot areas and how that adaptation has had to happen to be able to do that. And I think that is what makes the Homo sapiens and the modern humans a very different kind of species to some of the others that have gone extinct.
Give us a call, 011-883-0702, Dr. Christopher Yelverton with Professor Shahid Nala talking about the discovery and the implications of the discovery of Australopithecus sediba. Why was Australopithecus sediba called Australopithecus sediba, Professor Nala?
Sorry, I just missed that. You broke up for a second.
Sorry, I'm interested in the motivation behind the labeling of this particular species. Is it geographical, the Australopithecus sediba? Why is it called that?
I think it's to do with as Dr. Elderton and yourself indicated, it's to do with the timeline. But it's also to do with you know, location. So when you look at the word sediba, its origin is linked to a spring. So, you know, where these fossils were actually found, it's almost like they were found in what was termed a death trap, and there was water situated in the bottom part of this potentially 20, 30, 40 meter drop. So, you know, the names are generally, I wouldn't say arbitrary, but they are named specifically to, if they are linked to some feature. So, you know, the whole idea, the importance of these fossils, of sediba specifically, if you look at it, it's one of the largest assemblages of fossilized material that's been found.
Yeah.
And it's basically looking at over 200, close to 300 specimens.
Yeah.
Coming back to the technology.
Yeah.
So, you know, the technology that had been used to expose, for example, these lumbar vertebrae, previously you would sit with a hammer and chisel and dig away the breccia to expose this fossil bone. Now we don't have to even go and break into the block. We actually utilize scanning technologies where we can see into a block, get an image of that, and utilizing then technology, you could actually 3D print the actual fossil. So, you know, the utilization of technologies in paleosciences has taken paleosciences to a different level utilizing CT scans, micro CT, and this is the other thing that has allowed the projects that we are currently busy with to work at a different speed compared to previously.
Yeah. I want to invite our listeners to this conversation on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. As you listen to this conversation, what pops out at you? What are the learnings that you are getting out of this conversation? What do you believe the significance of this discovery is of Australopithecus sediba? I know that there's been other species of Australopithecus. I remember hearing of Australopithecus africanus. Later we heard of, and that was a big conversation, Homo naledi. And the conversation became so convoluted, Dr. Yelverton. It became philosophical. It became political. People were asking questions like, well, what tribe was this? Or which who are these people? Yeah. Help me formulate the language for how we speak about these issues in a more accessible way for our listeners, in that how these species, these creatures were not people, right? They weren't human beings as we understand human beings now. What were they, and why is it significant that we have now discovered them?
So I think, you know, as you say, I mean, we can't really equate, you know, our modern human concepts to most of these guys. You know, I mean, the Australopithecus, they, as I said, I mean, they were probably 4 million years ago that some of them were around. They probably didn't use tools. They probably had limited ability to communicate with each other, and they were fairly ape-like, really, in terms of what they did. I think that it's only, and I mean, that was really part of the big debate when, and that was probably part of your debate when you were talking about it, is probably when they found Homo naledi.
Yeah.
And they were looking at the cave system, and those were really unique because they were fairly large deposits of bones relating to that you could almost separate out into individuals, and that's the whole discussion, as I said, especially with the finding Leti, the skull, and the kind of idea that this skull was by itself on top of a kind of ridge with no other bones around, and what Professor Berger is proposing is that it's further evidence that at that stage there was some type of ritualistic burial that was happening, but there's no evidence for any of the others before.
And Dr. Yelverton, what that would mean, I'm sorry I'm jumping in because I really want to stay close to, but what that would mean is that the concept of ritual had already begun, if I understand you correctly, and that is a uniquely human undertaking, a uniquely but then I seem to remember conversations about dolphins, for example, or elephants, for example, that will yearly go back and go and see the bones of their ancestors. Is it really true to assume that, you know, the fact that there was a burial site, for example, is the introduction of a uniquely human faculty? Dr. L. Yelverton?
So I think you know, we also need to be careful with, especially like with animals, because we tend to anthropomorphize our emotions on them.
Yeah.
And whether or not with the Homo naledi it was a recognition of death, or whether it was actually a ritualized process, you know, as you said, I mean, the elephants seem to have a recognition of death, but whether or not it's a ritualized emotive response is difficult to tell. And I think, you know, that's really where Professor Berger is you know, he's really got the strongest kind of ideas on that in terms of his finds within those cave systems. Because, you know, especially if you look at those cave systems, I mean, if you look at how difficult it is for them to get deep within those caves, you know, there's a lot of discussion around how did they get into those caves and how did they get that deep into the caves? You know, whether or not they possibly even had fire that they used, maybe to give themselves light of some sort. And these are obviously fairly difficult questions to actually answer, because we don't always have evidence to do it. So some of it is based on what we're seeing, almost an extrapolation of that.
Yeah. Professor Nala, I'm going to ask you to answer this question after the break. So the question reads, so the human being is from which ape since the evolution? Will humans ever evolve to something different? And I suppose, in a way, it's still the question that I asked Professor Yelverton as to whether or not we, as a species now, are transitionary. Are we going to see a next step in the evolution of the species that we are? And how long does it take for us to know whether a species is as is it's created or it is in a transitionary process? Please think about that question. I see some calls are starting to come in. I'd love to take those calls on 011-883-0702 or 021-446-0567. This is The Weird and the Wonderful. Let's take a break.
702. Let's walk the talk.
Streaming countrywide on the 702 app.
Dr. Christopher Yelverton is my guest. Professor Shahid Nala, both of them professors at the University of Johannesburg, talking about the discovery of Australopithecus sediba and the implications thereof. Yeah, what does it mean to us? What should we take out of this discovery? Are the questions that we are asking aware of the complexities that are involved here? Are these complexities manufactured? Do we need to have a degree to understand these issues? Why is this important to all of us? Can I quickly take this call, Professor Nala, and then you can perhaps help us with that question. Tepo in Madibeng, hi.
Hi. Good evening, Audrey.
Yeah, go ahead, Tepo.
Yes, my question is, did the Homo species and the others that crossed probably in Europe, did they meet together and mate, probably develop another species? The second part, I know that there's a debate. I'm a layman who just reads. Did the other, probably, because there's a debate, did the ones that come from Africa, who went first into Europe, which species went first into Europe? Did we mate also? Are we having mixed genes? Are we having crossed genes? Is it possible? And the other part that I want to ask.
Tepo. All right, let's just deal with those two questions. Otherwise, we won't be able to.
That's the last one.
Okay.
Why do we have most concentration of the remains, archaeological remains, around Southern Africa, and mostly on the western side, at least Ethiopia and so forth? But what is happening in the eastern side of Africa? That's all that I wanted to ask.
Tepo in Madibeng, much appreciated. Professor Nala?
I think it was breaking up here, but I think, you know, the whole theory of migration, like I mentioned earlier, comes into play. And he's talking of an interesting thing. An interesting thing of the mixing or interbreeding, if you want to call it that. So did the species breed, and then subsequent to that, what was the new species that came through? This is a discussion that is taking place with, for example, you know, the Neanderthals.
Yep.
And the modern human, at some point, was there almost an in-between species that featured as a subsequent mating between these two species. So, you know, it is a discussion that is taking place. There's no definitive answer that can be given, because it is still being explored, if you can call it that.
Yeah.
I hope that answers the question. Coming back to your question before the break, you know, I think our evolution is taking place more at a micro than at a macro level. So yes, there are new anatomical findings, if you want to call it that, Okay, but these findings are more at a micro than at a macro level, whereas the findings that we are seeing in the different species, fossil, extinct common species, those are more macro. So the micro level is what's happening at a cellular level, and this relates specifically to the functionality of the structures that we are dealing with. So, for example, you know, how is the brain further developing? So we're not seeing massive changes in brain architecture, but possibly in how the brain is functioning. So, you know, as technologies become more advanced, as those technologies are literally taking over the thinking processes that we are going through. So the whole concept of artificial intelligence is starting to reiterate. So, you know, what's going to be happening to parts of the body if we don't utilize them over time? Or if we do see a requirement for another structure to develop that will allow us to further our expansion beyond our earthly realm. So, you know, I think we are going through a process of a more physiological evolution rather than an anatomical evolution, and also more of a philosophical dash spiritual evolution rather than a morphological evolution. And that's where we are at the moment, I think.
I want to go back to the fundamentals of the question raised by Tepiso around issues of geography, Africa, the very idea of an Africa 2 million years ago. I mean, if we're talking about, and Professor Yelverton, you mentioned the idea of anthropomorphizing certain concepts and making them human when they aren't necessarily a human concept. The recognition of death by elephants and dolphins and the like. The idea that we still speak in terms of the geopolitical concepts of 2021 about the realities of 2 million years ago, and through no fault, I suppose, of our own, because we have no other reference. But is that the way to understand the realities of 2 million years ago, by referencing them on ideas of geographical, political, philosophical ideas of 2021 to talk about 2 million years ago?
No, I think things were totally different then. I think in many cases the climate might have been very different during that period of time. So the landscape would have been very different. You know, if we go further back, even, you know, if we look even further to Gondwanaland, when the continents were kind of more linked together, you know, I think things are very different now, just in terms of what we see and what is around us, you know, compared to what was happening then. And as you said, I think, you know, these guys lived in a totally different environment. You know, it wasn't like they would be communicating or in the same way that we do now. You know, they were in all likelihood very primitive kind of creatures that you know, they were not human. I mean, that's just the bottom line. They weren't human. So when we're going back to sort of 3-4 million years ago, you know, it was various animals living together and interacting with each other. And, you know, we it's unlikely that they would have bred together, because a lot of them didn't exist together. Some of the Australopithecus did exist during the same sort of time period, but certainly not with modern humans. As Professor Nuller said, I mean, it's just Neanderthals that there's a discussion about whether or not they could, because it might have been firstly unlikely that they would have interacted with each other, because they could possibly have been in competition with each other. And that's one of the things with humans, where, you know, the competition and our ability to use tools and weapons probably gave us a distinct advantage. And then obviously later on, the ability to use more and more intelligence that became the forefront in Homo sapiens, which probably also made us such a successful species.
Yeah. Professor Nala, I mean, the fact that these creatures lived so long ago with completely, perhaps, completely different realities is understood. But they do have some bearing on how we emerge as a species now, right? So I go back to the question asked by Tsepiso to ask, how much of who and what we are as a species now, yeah, is attributable to Australopithecus sediba? You've spoken, for example, about the fact that this creature walked on its hind legs like we do at the moment, or similar to what we do, but was able to use its limbs to climb trees, its upper limbs to climb trees. To what extent do we now come to any conclusion about that creature's contribution to who we are? How do we frame that in our minds, and how conclusive does that framing become?
It's a difficult question to answer, but the only thing that I can think of is that the spirit carries on through the eons of time. So when the freedom of the upper limb came and featured, and it opened up that opportunity for that upper limb now to be utilized for a different purpose, it then had an impact on, I think, the thought processes on brain development, on thought processes subsequent to that. So it's more of a philosophical timeline pull through of the spirit of humanity, if you want to call it that, that comes through to a time that we are currently in. And this is something, you know, man always strives for improvement.
Yeah.
So these creatures, at some point, there may have been some. And now again, we are transposing a human aspect onto this creature. There may have been something that ignited a spirit to say, "Let's engage with the dead in this manner," or, you know, we engage with the tool in this manner. So it's a very challenging question to answer.
Yeah,
it's an unknown. It's an unknown philosophical discussion that we need to engage with.
Yeah. As we wrap up, now we have made this discovery. We have minds and brain power from all over the world looking at all of these things and discussing them. What is it that we should understand are the challenges that these kinds of discoveries make for humanity at the moment? What vistas does it open for us? Resolved or unresolved, Professor Yelverton, what does this present as challenges, as new ways of understanding? What does it present to us as the current Homo sapien?
You know, not from a philosophical perspective, but I think in some ways from a clinical perspective, I think we can also take some of what we're finding with this, because there's certain things that we, like low back pain and curvatures in the spine, scoliosis, the certain degenerative processes that we see, which we don't see in any of the fossils or in any of the other great apes like gorillas and chimpanzees and orangutans. So we, from a clinical perspective, we actually are able to also bring in to help us to understand clinically why are we seeing some of the conditions that we're seeing in more modern humans.
Yeah.
And I think that's also important, because that's a very practical application that we can take from what we're finding with these, because the pathologies that we're seeing, as I say, are quite different, but some of them are the same. You know, the more finds we have, the more pathologies we're likely to find. But I do think that it's not just from a kind of philosophical approach.
Yes.
From an actual practical perspective, we can actually glean more information about what's happening in modern humans as well, in terms of the way we move and what we do.
Andrew is in Rosebank. Very quickly. Hi, Andrew.
Yeah, hi, good evening. This I'd like to ask the professor is that the question is, if you've got different types of humanoids in the past and different types of ape kind of animals, why are there not different types of humans that we get at the moment now? Why are all humans really the same? Why do we all look the same kind of thing in that regard? Why are apes so different and different types of apes, and now there are no different types of humans? What's happened to all these kind of humanoid creatures?
Thanks very much for that question, Andrew. And I suppose it's that whole transitionary evolutionary question. Prof, how do you respond, Professor Nala?
I think we're in that timeline where we're not seeing such differentiated or such differences. But, you know, within the human, the modern human, you can still see some differences. So, you know, if we look at, for example, let's take an Aboriginal individual versus a European, there would be physical differences. That does not make us a different species, but we still belong to the same modern human species. So there are those differences, you know, physical differences, but we are still one species. Mm. The difference in species happens across a long timeline, I think.
Mm.
So, you know, we are at this moment in time, and, you know, it's a very small unit of time across the full spectrum of the timeline that we're dealing with.
Yeah.
And that's why we're not seeing those dramatic differences.
Yeah. I think the time issue is a very, very important one, because the scale, the amounts of time that we're talking about here are huge. I mean, somebody just sent me a message to say we all of us in the Northern Africa 2,000 years ago, then we moved down south because of the Europeans and Arabs invaders. This person is talking about 2,000 years ago. And this conversation is about 2 million years ago. So I suppose the time spans that we are discussing here are so huge that sometimes they boggle our minds, Prof, that maybe even as a species, the Homo sapiens, we've been around here for a blink of an eye in terms of the amounts of times that we're talking about here, Professor Nala?
Yeah, I think, you know, they always refer to that as the second hand turning around the clock. So we are actually living in the last second of a timeline, of a 24-hour timeline.
Yeah.
So it takes you to that level of where we are at. So it's one blink, like you mentioned, on a timeline that spans eons. We talk here millions of years.
Yeah. Prof, where do we get to find out more about this topic? Where can we read up more if indeed there is literature?
I think, you know, the World Wide Web is open.
Yeah.
And this was the display. I think the open access that now we have to these fossils, and this was part of Lee's push, that paleo needs to be more open access. And, you know, the exposure that this is having,
yeah,
that we are opening up science to our next generation.
Yeah.
They need to come in and, you know, let's make this a South African project, which is one part of the African project, which is one part of the humanities project.
Prof, I've got to stop there. We've run out of time. Professor Shahid Nala and Dr. Christopher Yelverton, thank you very much for your time.